Hello and welcome to the ARO Global Full Year 2024 Results. My name is Sergey, and I will be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero, and you will be connected to an operator. On the call today, we have Zak Lewi, Group Chief Executive Officer and Group Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepard, Group Chief Financial Officer. I will now hand you over to your host, Zak Lewi, to begin today's call. Over to you, Mr. Lewi. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. It's a pleasure to talk to you all. As Sergey mentioned, my name is Zak Lewi. I'm the CEO and CIO of ARO Global. It's a pleasure to present our full year results for 2024. Moving to slide three to start. As you see, we've made good progress on all of the key metrics. As we will highlight throughout my section and Phil's section, 2024 was a very strong year for the business, transformative in several areas, and good progress in others. And so we'll point out those highlights as we go through. As you know, we own the largest vertically integrated fund manager in Europe. We are enthusiastic about that business model because it really unlocks the middle market size points and asset exposures. And without that, it's very hard to access those kind of assets. What's interesting is that that is by far the largest part of the European market. It is granular asset-backed exposures serviced and originated locally, which our model is perfect for, and we'll talk through that as we go through the sections. Funds under management grew nicely year on year. Obviously, with us moving to ACO III later this year, we expect that to grow strongly through the course of 2024. Deployment significantly increased, particularly in the second half of 2024. That was driven by both strong ACO II deployment, but also the launch of our lending fund, ALO, which got to size. We closed 1.1 billion of commitments in just the second half of 2024. And so the combination of ACO and ALO, multi-billion euro fund strategies deploying alongside each other in terms of activity through the second half of 2024, led to that strong second half deployment total, obviously up 67% on prior year. That led to, obviously, a strong pull-through in FRE, in the actual profitability of the fund manager, to 69.1 million, up 55% on prior year. And realizations were also pleasingly strong at up 49% at 1.2 billion for 2024. Realizations inside the ACO strategies were 850 million euros a year, which compared to the NAV of the fund was an incredibly good realization rate and led to very accretive recycling and good fund performance for our investors. If I move to page four, you will see that we continue to grow the platform. We've done that in a way that's very accretive to equity and constructive to our franchise while not being capital consumptive by our holding company. I'll talk through the details now. We're up to servicing 110 billion euros in assets, which is obviously a great place to be. It gives us a strong footprint from which to source transactions for our funds, both from the lending side and from buying credit and also from the real estate equity side. The meaningful gains in 2024 were on taking it from west to east. On the Spanish side, we announced in June the transaction with CPPIB to acquire Mistra. That has strengthened and deepened as both an operation and a partnership. It takes us to 15 billion euros of assets that we service in Iberia and makes us a real leader in that geography. Most of you will know we, at the fund level, completed the transaction with Iccrea. The final closing is forthcoming, but all regulatory clearances are now done. That is the SOFCARD vote. And so we've made good progress in getting that transaction completed. That obviously has a very strong market share in France, which will be good for origination opportunities for us, alongside a strong position in Italy, which further supports our capability in Italy. It's very complementary to the platforms we have in Italy already. And on the German side, we did the Innervoted transaction, which cost only 2 million euros to the holding company to buy the OpCo, and that created investment opportunities for our funds to participate in the EPICOs, which we've been able to execute in the second half of 24. Taken together, we really feel confident in our platform. Now we really do cover Western Europe strongly. Obviously, Germany, we'd like to do more in the future, given Interbone's a bit smaller, just over a billion of AUM, where in other markets, you know, France, Iberia has 20 billion, Iberia, we now have 15 billion, Italy, we have 45 billion, UK, we have more than 10, Ireland, we have 11, et cetera. So we've got to a point where this really is the go-to platform for Western Europe, particularly for middle market asset-backed exposures. There is limited further activity we need on the geographic side. We don't have territorial ambitions outside of Western Europe, so this really is the footprint we want. And obviously, having done a lot to improve it in 2024, we'll take a period of time to consolidate those gains and integrate hard over the course of 24. But we've already made, you know, good tactical investments off the backs of the expanded footprint. Having deployed 1.4 billion of ACO money in calendar 24, I think having the new geographies on top all point to the capacity for ACO 3 to be larger, which is obviously accretive to the franchise. If I move to page 5, we summarize that, as we've discussed it earlier in terms of the product perspective. ACO 2 is now about 100% gross deployed, but given the very strong realizations we had in ACO 2, we're in the kind of high 60s% net deployed. We'll cross over into the ACO 3 territory orders of magnitude this summer. And so we'll have, with some degree of flexibility around that. And so we're making good progress towards moving that franchise forward, both in returns, where ACO 2 has done particularly well, as well as in terms of scale, both from a deployment perspective and from a execution perspective. Obviously, thereby, we'll have to fundraise that process to raise ACO 3. The franchise remains in that ACO series, as it always was, you know, granular, relatively small investments. In ACO 2, we've already made more than 100 investments, mostly off-market, mostly hanging off our platform sourcing capability. If I move to ALO, we've closed $1.1 billion in 2024. That all got done between the first close in July and the final close, which will be early in 2025. But the $1.1 billion is what we completed in 2024. We've invested $400 million of that to date. Again, we're making very strong progress in that lending fund, which is a really strong product. We're targeting $1.5 billion as the total size of ALO1. On real estate equity strategies, we did a couple of things, both opportunistic and thematic. Strong support from existing investors who backed us in that area, and that continues to be a growth area for us. So as you look out the pieces, we're really attacking middle market asset-backed collateral from really two different parts of the capital structure. ACO, which buys out NPLs, bankruptcies, restructurings, and end-of-life assets where we're the servicer, really the types of credit that sell at a discount to par. Our lending fund, which frankly lends against extremely similar underlying collateral, where Meslow, what we took over from the team at Elba in Spain, from our Dutch lending platform, from our Irish lending platform that hangs off Mars, from different areas of our franchise. We drive very strong lending deals, both in bridge lending and in specialty mortgages, and that has performed well. That book is really good. We're happy with both the IRRs and the loan-to-values of those underlying positions, and investors have been supportive there. Obviously, you saw the big announcement we made with Adya in the summer, who anchored that strategy. And we've had really good growth in that in the second half of 24 and expect to see similar in early 25 before we close out at LO1. But not real estate equity. Obviously, from a timing perspective, there's some really interesting deals there. But from a fundraising perspective, real estate equity is much harder to raise at this point in the cycle. And so we're being tactical to make sure that the capital we have raised there, we deploy really well. And then, you know, we'll turn our focus to that. But obviously, the main event for 2025 is going to be in this part of our business, really driving ACO3 to the right size and the right capital construct. Moving to page six, just a little more detail on our investors. 50% of them come from Europe. Strong bases in Netherlands, Nordics, Switzerland, amongst other regions. Middle East is 17%. That's been a good region. The strong backing across all recent products. Asia-Pac is 12%. We picked up good momentum in Australia on top of what we previously did in other parts of Asia. And North America growing nicely at 21%. That was back at 18% earlier in the year, so that we've been able to expand that nicely and continue to focus there on keeping our North American client base. The quality of LPs is very strong, as you already know from previous presentations. You know, where the magnitude, a third sovereign wealth, a third pension, and then split between insurance and other. The average LP is very large, as you see by most industry comps. Which talks to the institutional quality of the product. I mean, what's really happening is investors realize that they can onboard us and get access to middle market European exposures across a range of products. We've become a main commitment for them to fill out their European allocation and become a core panel member who are picking up a lot of cross-selling where, as you see across the entire investor base now, more than 40% of investors have more than one product with us, which is obviously very encouraging. As I move to page seven, it really lays out why this is interesting. As you know, 82% of activity in the Eurozone is domestic. Most of Europe is way too fragmented to efficiently securitize and risk transfer, which leaves the banking system with numbers of challenges. First, that the banks basically have to delever in certain areas and become more capital efficient and less operationally intensive. That really feeds both ACO and ALO. ACO, where they try and delever by selling loans. ALO, where they just can't act in the specialty areas like bridging specialty mortgages. And we get to own last mile of lending. Obviously, the key to that, though, is you need to have a local footprint, which gives you access to those activities. And as you saw from prior pages, the quality of that franchise is growing strongly. As you also know, there's about 14 trillion of asset-backed middle market assets in Europe. I mean, it is the largest asset class in Europe by a mile. It is those middle market asset-backed exposures, which are profoundly local. And by having local leaders in each of the different areas, from mortgage servicing to, you know, construction lending to bridge lending, to some of the real estate strategies that we run, you really have a strong both sourcing, underwriting, and asset management advantage, and we've done even better, I think, materially in 2024 than in prior years of consolidating our leadership in that franchise and then obviously getting the investor support to express that leadership across multiple parts of the capital structure, from both lending to credit opportunities to real estate equity. Which then takes me to page eight. As the business is expanding, we'd expect to get to circa $15 billion of AUM in the medium term, about a $5 billion growth. I think just a combination of ACO and ALO continuing to do will get us to that target that is large enough to enable us to invest $3 billion a year. Internally, we are really driving the business using that thought process, which is we are doing a good job if by the latter part of this decade, call it 2027, we're at a point where we can raise $3 billion a year. We've obviously proven we can do that. Where we can deploy $3 billion a year, we're making good progress towards that goal. If you annualize the second half of 2024's run rate, we're not terribly far away from that. And having realizations of $3 billion a year, which obviously, given the growing deployment profile, is going to be a lagging indicator. But again, on a ratios basis, we're making decent progress to that. And I think at that level, we obviously de-lever very strongly through incredibly strong fee income and massive growth of FRE. But again, I think all the franchise advantages and current trajectories deliver that. There's nothing else we need to do endogenous other than just execute, raise money, invest money, and achieve realizations in the ordinary course. Achieve these metrics here, including that critical one. This helps drive the value of our discretionary NAV, which, as you know, is the highest margin part of our franchise, to greater than $6 billion. That will deliver a 40% return on our co-invest into those strategies, which obviously is a massive return on assets and super higher than our cost of funds and therefore incredibly accretive to shareholders and de-leveraging to bondholders, which will drive leverage down to that three times and below the life of our current maturity. So that's what we're doing. And in that sense, this will be, I think, quite a programmatic set of updates over the course of this year as we just simply execute that plan. But with that, let me pass to Phil, who can walk you through the further details of the numbers. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach. Good morning, everyone. An overview of the performance of the group is shown on slide 10. I'm pleased to report that group EBITDA increased by 133% to $90.1 million, and there's been a 67% reduction in the loss after tax as the business continues to scale on our capital-light fee-related earnings grow. I'll now go through each reporting segment in detail. Starting with the integrated fund management segment, which includes our capital-light earnings and is shown on slide 11. Fee-related revenues grew 37% to $302.9 million, driven by the scaling of our discretionary fund management business and winning 100 third-party asset management mandates. Revenues have continued to grow faster than costs, leading to a 55% growth in EBITDA to $69.1 million and an improvement in the margin from 20.2% in 2023 to 22.8% in 2024. The integrated fund management segment comprises the capitalized earnings from both the fund and asset management services provided to our discretionary funds and from the activities we provide to our third-party clients. Slide 12 has the performance of the fund and asset management services provided to our discretionary funds, ACO, our real estate fund, AREO, and our lending fund, ALO. As we've described on prior earnings calls, the deployment of capital drives the growth in the NAV of the funds, which in turn drives the revenues. The discretionary fund management fee-related revenues grew $30 million to $110.7 million. Based upon a 10% co-investment level, the group targets capitalized returns of 30% on the capital invested by Arrow. This is broadly split 10% from fund management activities, 10% from asset management and servicing, and 10% from performance fees. And to date, we have not recognized any performance fees. Deployment was strong in the final quarter, with €2.1 billion deployed during 2024, which grew the fund NAV to €3.4 billion at the end of the year and an average NAV of £2.4 billion. The year-on-year growth in the average NAV of circa 40% drives broadly an equivalent 40% growth in the discretionary fund management fee-related revenues. Given we generate fees on deployed capital and there is upfront investment in people and systems to build fundraising and investment capabilities, there is an inherent lag between the current deployment and the build of the income streams. Slide 13 seeks to demonstrate this dynamic using two illustrative scenarios based firstly upon the 2024 deployment level of €2.1 billion, and secondly upon the medium-term target deployment level of €3 billion. Assuming the group continues to deploy at these levels in future years, with a similar investment profile to the current deployment, then NAV will grow to €5.8 billion and €8.3 billion under the two illustrative scenarios respectively. At the target returns, then the level of integrated fund management earnings will grow to approximately £170 million and £235 million respectively. These scenarios assume the third-party asset management earnings remain at 2024 levels. These illustrative scenarios demonstrate the growth potential in our capital-light earnings and the significant upside to the enterprise value of the group. In addition to the discretionary fund management performance, we also drive third-party asset management returns, as shown on slide 14. We provide asset management administration and servicing on circa €80.5 billion of assets managed for third parties, in addition to the funds under management of €4.7 billion managed on behalf of third parties under non-discretionary mandates, for example, within Sagita in Italy. Third-party asset management revenues grew £52.1 million to £192.2 million in the year, with £30 million of the increase due to platforms fully acquired since 2023, in particular Maslow. Revenues also grew with 100 new asset management mandates won during the year. The group has continued to expand and invest in our local platforms to support our discretionary fund management proposition. It is inevitable that third parties also recognise the strength and market-leading positions of our local platforms, which has driven the strong level of mandate wins and contributed to the growth. Previously, and I reiterate that I expect third-party asset management revenues to grow at mid to high single digit through the cycle, with average margins of circa 15% for the broad array of services provided. Turning now to slide 15 and the results for the balance sheet segment. This segment reflects the investment returns of the back book investments, along with the assets return, the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds, such as ACO, ALO and ARIO. EBITDA has increased by £29.5 million to £55.7 million for the year, and the year-on-year improvement is primarily driven by two factors. Firstly, following our usual re-evaluation of our investment carrying values, there was a small impairment adjustment of £2.4 million in 2024. This is £24.5 million favourable to 2023, when the significant change in interest rates resulted in impairment of £26.9 million. The 2024 position reflects the stabilisation of interest rates, resulting in broadly stable underlying asset values. Secondly, the results of the prior year were impacted by the divestment of the UK portfolios, with no revenue or costs reported within the underlying results prior to the divestment. During 2024, a full year of revenue and costs on the 50% retained by Arrow have been recognised, resulting in a positive reported EBITDA of £4.7 million. The realisations performance by quarter is shown in the appendix. Gross realizations were $380 million during 2024, marginally up on last year and representing 107% of expected realizations. Balance sheet investments have reduced from $1.05 billion at the end of 2021 to $706 million at the end of 2024, driven by our capital light strategy. As co-investment levels reduce, with typical co-investment in ACO1 at 25%, reduced to 10% in ACO2, and reduced further to 7% in ALO, I expect to continue to drive strong free cash flow generation and continue to make good progress towards our leverage target of 3x. Moving on to the group segments, which is shown on slide 16, along with the full underlying results. Group costs primarily relate to the centrally controlled overhead costs and were 8% higher than prior year at $34.7 million. The current level of group segmental costs are reflective of a business now scaled to deliver deployment volumes of circa 2 to 3 billion euro per annum without any need for significant cost increase. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 16, which shows the EBITDA segmental results that I have explained. Despite the ongoing increase in the interest cost, the losses have been significantly reduced from 67.1 million to 21.9 million for 2024, reflecting the ongoing growth in fee-paying NAV, driving the growth in capitalized earnings and the improved profitability reported within the balance sheet segment. Finance costs increased from 102.8 million to 108 million due to the impact of both rising interest rates continuing to flow through the result and the refinancing completed in late 2024. In addition, as the group grows the euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest in our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a 7.6 million gain in 2024 against the gain of 4 million reported in 2023. Moving to slide 17 and the detailed breakdown of the free cash flow generation. Given the significant realizations during 2024 and the strong growth in our capital-light revenue streams, free cash flow generation after portfolio investments was 57.3 million for the year, up 12% on 2023. The reduction in our typical co-investment to 7% for ALO from 10% in ACO2 will further reduce the capital required for investments going forward, as our integrated fund management FRE continues to build alongside this reduced capital requirement. The free cash flow generation will continue to deliver the deleveraging of the balance sheet. In quarter four, we completed the refinancing of our bonds and RCF. Whilst we still had 2 years to the maturity of our bonds, de-risking the refinancing position was important. As set out on slide 18, we have extended all our maturities, both the bonds and RCF, until 2029. We achieved pricing at the tight end of the initial price talk, with the weighted average cost of debt for the group now 7.9% against 6.7% at Q3 2024. The tight pricing was driven by significant new money demand from both new and existing investors, and we fully maintained our liquidity headroom, creating additional headroom on the RCF to deal with the 97 million residual stub of existing bonds. I believe the success of the refinancing was achieved as the market understood our clear capitalized strategy and the excellent progress we've made in executing our strategy. Moving on to slide 19, which shows our leverage and funding position following the refinancing. The growing capitalized income and the free cash flow after investments have driven the reduction in leverage of 0.2 times from during 2024 to 3.7 times at the end of the year. Leverage has decreased from 4.8 times at the end of 2021, shortly after the take private transaction. Alongside the decrease in leverage, the group has further reduced net debt by $35.3 million in 2024, following the $26.7 million reduction in 2023. 2024 was a strong realizations year, and as shown in appendix on slide 27, full realizations in 2025 are expected to be lower at around $242 million, together with any realizations arising on investments made during the course of 2025. We have a strong funding base with maturities now pushed out to 2029 and significant levels of liquidity headroom. Our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to continue to expand our integrated fund management proposition across credit, real estate and lending. This in turn further drives fee-related earnings growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitates net debt reduction and further deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thanks, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. And just to close our presentation on page 21, I guess I would highlight 3 things in closing. The first is, I think we're fundamentally strategically correct, but both in the market we serve and the business model we deploy to serve it. The reality is that Europe is fragmented into 44 countries. It's a very local geography. 82% of transactions are local domestic, Germans lending to Germans, French lending to French, et cetera. And so having a fundamentally local model that operates in this vertically integrated way is a rare model in Europe that actually services the super majority of the European market. The fact that we've evidenced in multiple billion plus vehicles and products that we can do that across multiple parts of the capital structure with the same very high quality institutional backing from investors means that I think by any judgment, we are by a mile the best placed person to access what is that large and majority portion of the market. The second thing I'd say is that internally, we just have to execute that franchise day to day, just do a good job of raising capital, investing capital, and driving realizations and results. And that is very much the focused way in which we've managed the business while keeping group costs in an efficient form. And when you look at the results in the second half of 2024, not that you can prorate those, because obviously the second half is cyclically stronger than the first, but I think you'll see that we've delivered a really fantastic set of outturns in Q3 and Q4 of 24, and that momentum continues, you know, positively into Q1. We're enthusiastic with that progress. So what does that all mean for investors? I think we're attacking the right part of the market with the right business model. I think we've got the second point, we have the internal rhythm that drives performance in a measured way with clear targets. And I think for the bond market, what that will mean is a very arithmetic forward roll where, as you model us and you see the deployments come through, leading to the realizations coming through, leading to the fee capture along that journey, and you've seen the strong growth in all those metrics across 2024, that will improve the quality of earnings and the quantity of earnings, leading to ever-improving ratios. It won't happen in a straight line. I think we all would prefer it to just accelerate to the final outcome there and get to the end of the plan at the end of this debt maturity and achieve these targets that are on page 21. Obviously, the period in which cyclicality and lumpy realization deliver better quarters or worse quarters, but as we've shown in both Q3 and Q4 of 24, that volatility goes both ways, i.e. that those 2 quarters were positive to trend, good execution and good progress in those realizations. And I think as you see measured over years as opposed to quarters, I think the trajectory of this business is super clear that it is a growth machine in exactly the right segment with exactly the right business model, and so is incredibly well placed to succeed and I think that includes now both the balance sheet and the growth of our franchise and income statements. And with that, I'd like to pass the questions. So back to you, Serge, please.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1. And please make sure the mute function on your phone is switched off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. And we will pause for just a moment to assemble the queue. As a reminder again, it is star 1 to ask a question. We will now take our first question from Matt Hatton from Siron Capital. Please go ahead.
Hey guys, thanks for taking the question. I was just wondering, the $316 million of net realizations, can you give us a sense, I'm actually putting you on the spot a little bit here, of what the average money multiple or average IRR was on those? And if the answer is no, happy to, if you want to follow up on the email, that's fine.
Yeah, I can speak about the conceptual side of that, and then I guess, Phil, you can drive the more detail. But I mean, basically, the realizations come from three sources, right? I mean, it's basically the back book, i.e., things that existed pre-2020, before we moved to the fund management model, which have trended at a 15 IRR and a 1.6 multiple order magnitude when you aggregate the entirety of it over the long arc of that back book history. You have ACL1, which is roughly the same, 15 and between 1.6 and 1.7. And then you have ACL2, which is 20 and 1.7 pushing 1.8. So that's on the ACL side, which is the super majority of contribution to date. And then you've got ALO, where an order of magnitude, you're in the 11 to 12% deal level IRR range, and multiples are much shorter because obviously lending deals, the bridge lending deals, have a weighted average life of 14 months. And the other types of mortgages in that book are a little longer at more like 30 months. And so the answer to your question is a blanket average configuration of those numbers. I don't know off the top of my head what the average is when you actually pull out the 316 actual and divide it out into those constituent parts, but we can follow up with that on email. But that's, you know, I'll leave it to Phil if there's anything else you want to say. But it's an amalgamation of those different activities into that blend. So I pass back to you.
Yeah, the only other thing I would add to that is the realizations are on a slightly different basis. So the back book realizations are gross of servicing costs, whereas the our co-investment is net of servicing costs. So those levels that Zach has just given are effectively net of servicing costs for ACO, ALO, but for the back book they'll be higher than that because it's gross of servicing costs.
Sorry, so those are the net numbers for the back book.
Yes, they are. They're after servicing costs. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll now move to our next question from Bruno Reed Cutting from ADF Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hey guys. Could you just talk, I guess, the performance that you're kind of expecting this year? I guess obviously you had a very good year last year, but just to understand, I guess, the sequencing in collections you're expecting through 25 on, I guess, a quarterly basis in which we see the results. And on a similar note, just how we should expect the purchases to happen as well as you continue to increase deployments. Just trying to get a sense for what the sort of quarterly numbers will look like and I guess trajectory of both free cash and leverage.
Yeah. Shall I take that?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly we on slide 28 of the deck, we have the total realizations that we're expecting. Obviously that's before any collections and realizations on investments that we make during the course of this year. So the $242 million, it's relatively even by quarter. There's no whereas last year we had some, you know, very lumpy realizations happening in that generally happened in Q3 last year, that you should expect a far smoother profile. It won't be exactly 60-60-60 evenly spread, but it won't be it's not far off that. And then in terms of the origination volumes, I mean, we continue to scale. We did $2.1 billion last year. It was very back end loaded last year. I think we don't expect it to have that same profile, and so I would expect it to be clearly slightly weighted towards the back end, I think more even than last year. When you look at what does that mean, I mean, clearly I think importantly, you know, whenever you're looking at the business now, as sort of Zach mentioned, we've given the sort of, the build of how, our fee related earnings grow in particular from the discretionary fund management business. It is a function of the deployment driving the NAV, which drives the returns, and so the scaling of that, which obviously goes into the denominator of any leverage calculation. Clearly we're making those capitalized earnings are a significantly better quality earning than a realization where you've had to make the capital investment to acquire that realization. So, as Zach mentioned, we'd love this to be sort of smooth. I think, it's clearly we had a very lumpy year last year, which obviously flows through into the numbers this year as you're looking at the last 12 months for leverage. But I think a far smoother profile on a go forward basis. And it is just an arithmetic view of, the more we raise, realize, then we just get that increasing driver of fee related earnings. I hope that answers your question. I don't know whether you've got anything to add to that, Zach.
Yeah, the only thing I would just add is the realizations are lumpy based on what assets either get fully realized, collected, sold, refinanced away, et cetera, and that contributed to the lumpiness of realization profile. That's not going to go away because as you do asset-backed exposures, obviously when the asset sells or refinance, it's going to have a lumpy consequence. And obviously the lumpiness went in our favor in Q3 and Q4 of last year. We do expect that over time to get better because the lending side is more programmatic, where the ACO product is more opportunistic. And so measured in years as opposed to quarters, you should expect to see a more smooth profile as the programmatic lending goes out and comes back in pretty predictable weighted average lives, where ACO will still have a lumpiness that is just the inherent consequence of opportunistic strategies. On the deployment side, when you plot out the Q1 and Q2 deployment versus the Q3 and Q4 deployment, it's a striking contrast. I mean, Q3 and Q4 were materially higher, I mean, more than double the amount. That is a very, to Phil's point, exacerbated cyclicality that won't happen again. And the reason why is that Q1 and Q2 didn't have any contribution from Arrow Lending Opportunities, which is obviously a billion-plus franchise, where Q3 and Q4 had material contribution from that lending franchise. And obviously with that fund being recycling-oriented, you know, a typical 3+5+2 drawdown format, et cetera, that fund and its successor vehicles are all going to be big contributors. And so the big jump you saw from H1 to H2 last year wasn't just cyclicality of people choosing to sell in Q4, et cetera. It was that our lending opportunities came fully on stream to augment the volume load. So that's a more structural, permanent improvement that shown in the second half of last year, but will full year effect all the way through this year. And so that will lead to a more successful growth of deployment and a more balanced profile between H1 and H2. Otherwise, I've got nothing else to add.
Okay. Thanks, guys. That's very helpful. A couple more questions. I guess any update you can give us on your performance fee expectations, given obviously getting through the first ACO fund and I guess, again, just how we should expect that to come through the numbers from an accounting perspective?
No update from what we sort of said in the prospectus at the time of the refinancing. So still expecting ACO1 to be around about €40 million for the, and this is for the corporate, with recognition 2025-26, and then ACO2 €125 million with recognition something like 2029.
Okay, that's helpful. Just remind me just kind of what you're saying about ACO3, but just the kind of expectations just in terms of timing and size.
So we haven't published a target size yet, and I think with the SEC rules, we have to be a little bit careful given it's a public call. But it will be larger than ACO2, and I think if you look at the fact that the ACO series alone deployed $1.4 billion last year, and we typically target something like, you know, a 3-year investment period. So if we convince investors successfully that we could do what we did last year, you know, for the next 3 years, minus what is recycling, so you wouldn't multiply it exactly out, but minus recycling, you start to get to a sensible target that is based on actuals and is based on current run rates and not any kind of hope note. Conviction in supporting that size is also further enhanced by the fact that we've got, obviously, Germany, France, and Spain in that better position, as we highlighted at the start of the meeting. So that's probably all I can say on sizing, but that's basically just to extrapolate out what you think is reasonable size. We'll obviously update you as soon as we're allowed to on that. Timing, hopefully I gave enough of an insight to that in the chat, but I mean, ACO2 deployment at the end of 2024 was just over $2.5 billion. It's a $2.75 billion fund. So on a gross basis, it was almost fully deployed at the end of 24. Because realizations have been strong, there's been over $700 million of realizations in that fund. Combined with the use of sublines, we have a bit more capacity. We typically target trying to start the next fund when we're 80% net deployed. We'll get to that level at some point over the summer, but obviously we'd want to line up capital behind that. We've got a bit of wiggle room just because 80% gives us a headroom, obviously. We have some co-invest vehicles and other things that can take excess volume if that comes necessary. But, I mean, I think that broadly speaks to timing over the course of this year with a focal point towards the second half of this year.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. And then just my final question was just obviously you're kind of talking about, the sort of geographic expansion, but how should we kind of think about the strategy, sort of strategy there in terms of M&A? And, you know, in obviously you've done a lot of deals recently in terms of buying up some of these more sort of distressed players. I mean, do you see much more opportunity for those kind of names out there, or do you think it's largely done?
So we're very happy with our current territorial footprint. I mean, our territorial ambition was Western Europe, and we've now fulfilled that. As I said earlier, I would prefer to be larger in Germany than we are, but I don't think that's an overwhelming requirement. We have over $1 billion of assets there that we manage already, and a strong team there, and we can build from that positive starting point. So I feel like the case for further M&A is not a priority in geographic terms. In terms of buying out the competitor set or consolidating on some of the distressed situations, hopefully that's been transparent that we've done that through our funds, which creates good origination optionality for us, and some great expansion of our coverage footprint. But we have not deployed any material Topco capital. I think the numbers were out that we spent order of magnitude $4 million in Spain doing what we did there, and $2 million in Germany doing what we did there. So and we got incredible bang for the buck in terms of scalability and market positioning from that. If you match obviously the public situations with Akira and with AIF, those were with the funds, which great further investment opportunities, but again, did not require Topco capital. So hopefully, if you judge us by our actions, as Phil and I have highlighted for quite some time, the priority is deleveraging. The fact that we've been able to grow both the products we have in the market and grow our geographic footprint whilst getting secure net debt down materially over the last two periods, I think suggests what our priorities are, and that's not going to change. So I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting industry noise around whether the big names that have been going through restructurings create further opportunities, and there may be one or two more things to do, I would say. But I think we're in the late innings of that process. I mean, I think we... if we do one more, I'd be pleased, and I think you know we have a line of sight to that. But I think that game is largely played out now.
Okay, that's helpful. And so I just have one very final question. But obviously, you guys have moved a lot sort of away from unsecured NPLs to sort of more secured stuff. I was just wondering how do you see the unsecured market in Europe at the moment? Is it still something that you think is growing in attractiveness, or do you kind of still see it as unattractive as it has been over the last sort of, you know, I guess, few years?
So I'll try and be concise, but I think there's a lot to say to that question. The issue, I guess, is, look, unsecured, we could debate whether it's in most of the target selling institutions, somewhere between 5 and 10% of the balance sheets of those banks. And so it was never an enormous asset class. And I think the sector got horribly overbuilt in the sense that it calibrated the fact that the bank sold unsecured first after 2008-09 and extrapolated out that volumetric. And a whole list of names did public bonds and public equities and other growth, private equity backing to attack a sector that was always only a minority of the activity. Given the fact it also trades at comparatively low cents in the dollar, the actual capital requirements are low. So for a fund manager, it's a difficult asset class because, one, it comes with more reputational risk. Two, it comes with more regulatory risk. Three, it's not all that scalable because to deploy multi-billion euro funds, you got to buy, you know, huge amounts of it. and the competitor set was horribly overbanked, if you will, or overbuilt versus the actual relative size of it on bank's balance sheet. So, I mean, obviously the fact that we sold our collection agencies to Intrum a couple of years ago, I guess the actions speak for themselves in terms of how we saw it. However, the forward role of it is a little different. I think the forward role is harder to prognosticate because it depends on where the economic cycle goes and where the regulatory climate goes. What I could say is that the winner of that battle is the person who's going to have scale. These are mostly factory-style operations, and B, digitization. And that requires commitment, investment, and scale. So, I mean, in the U.S., just looking across the pond, I mean, Encore and PRA dominate, right? So a market the size of the U.S., which is way larger than Europe in this sense, it has only two players. Europe still has a whole bunch of people who focus on unsecured. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And particularly in the U.S., you can use social security numbers. So the secured business is a highly precise data science where in Europe it's not. And so I guess we've kind of voted with our feet by leaving that sector through selling our collection agencies. I think what I've just described, hopefully the cogent rationale as to why, whether other folks can make it work. I think there was tremendous consolidation, good investments in digitization, good factory efficiency. There's a pathway to making it work. Whether it works as a capital light asset class, where, I mean, just run the math. If you've got to raise a couple billion euro funds, you have scale to do capital light, and then you buy the stuff at 10, 20 cents in the euro, you have to probably buy 10, 20 billion of it. I mean, you have to buy lots of it over time to be interesting. Can you do that in an efficient way in a very fragmented European market? I mean, obviously, we voted with our feet on that question. So I don't think it's impossible, but I think there's a lot that would have to improve from the buy side for that to be a attractive thesis. And it's not relevant to us. At all.
Okay, that's very helpful, Carter. Thanks, Zach. And cheers, Phil.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1. And our next question is from Carl Strecker from Guggenheim. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. You've kind of spoken to us a little bit, guys, but you don't have any kind of targets for 2025 you're sharing at this point beyond the medium term guidance, say in terms of deployments, for example. Is that something that you can give us a target on or guidance at this point or anything else for 2025 in terms of modeling?
Fair question, Carl. Let Phil and I think about that, and we'll reflect on what we want to share in the Q1 results. I guess we are, and I take the kindly stated, but in that sense, productive criticism. What we were trying to do, and I appreciate from a modeling trading perspective, this is probably frustrating and overly idealistic, is, I mean, now that the refinance is done, I think our focus is trying to kind of focus market sentiment in the same way that we're running our business internally, which is let's make sure the franchise is as strong as possible. I think we've made good progress there. But obviously, you see the pull-through, and it's just arithmetic common sense of what servicing fees combined with management fees combined with asset level returns and carry provide a return on assets. And so the critical number is how much can we deploy and build NAV. It was obviously the ingredients of that are good fund performance when investors back us and do fundraising to provide the dry powder to enable it. And you've seen for the first time we've published a dry powder number. So we're
I guess we're trying to think of it as a medium-term business because there is a risk that you get tied up the same way in 2023 or 2020, it's the Q3 or Q4 of last year where, you know, we settle a big loan or sell a Dutch mortgage back book, et cetera, and it has either a very strong quarterly outcome or to the extent it falls out of the denominator, a kind of adverse quarterly movement. And if you were in our shoes, I think the way you feel about that is, that's kind of a distraction on the basis of this bond maturity, that what really matters here is us getting to those medium targets. If you look at the numbers in Phil's section, obviously, if we get to raise $3 billion a year, deploy $3 billion a year, and have realizations of $3 billion a year, this business is spectacular on a declining leverage profile. And the actions in between here and there, we're obviously giving guidance on whole range of things around deployment and the fundraising elements that enable that. And obviously those will get announced all the way through the year. So we're trying to, to the extent it's a medium term hold, which follows that trajectory, I think we'll all do well as we have done together over the last, you know, 12, 18 months, to the extent that, we want to give more quarter to quarter guidance. I get, now sitting in your chair, why that's helpful, but let Phil and I reflect on how we can do that in a way that is productive, it doesn't distract from the bigger picture of what we're trying to convey, which is that that progression in franchise and in numbers to get to those ratios, which obviously is a matter of arithmetic, pull us to the right leverage outcome.
Yeah, understood. I guess in a similar vein, looking at the presentation, you've taken out the slide with it's called in the third quarter, it's called analysis of IFM EBITDA between discretionary local ancillary platforms. Like that's probably the most important slide in the entire reporting package from my perspective, because it allows us to, you know, effectively look at the AUM versus the EBITDA / revenue from those two discrete strategies. Can you continue to report that going forward? Like, can you provide it for this quarter? Because, look, I understand your perspective on it, but I think as bond investors, and this is the way the whole market works, we look at it on a quarterly basis. Obviously, there's a longer term picture, and I do think that that's slightly different from, let's say, an investor in one of your funds, because it's a lockup fund and, you know, it's effectively fund investors who are providing equity, whereas it is a different perspective for bond investors for good or for bad. We do look at this on a quarterly basis, and it's important. I think, you know, there's still that progression in the asset light income, and it's important for us to be able to see that progressing and model it progressing on at least an annual basis anyway. So is it possible to provide that slide on an ongoing basis?
I mean, clearly there's been some change in the nomenclature, but the discretionary fund management performance slide is effectively what we used to refer to as the discretionary core strategies. And so you'll see that we've given the revenue split there, you know, you'll see in the footnote the average NAV. So the average NAV of 2.4 billion sterling gives you the effectively the EBITDA level for that segment, and then the local ancillary is just been rebranded third party asset management performance, and you'll see that you know those third party revenues at the target margin of 15% will give you the EBITDA margin for what we previously were the local ancillary strategies. So and then clearly there was an investment drag which is ongoing. So The information is all there. I'm happy to have a separate call, Carl, just to go through that. But there's no change in what we're the information that we're presenting there is just shown in a slightly different format. But happy to pick up with you after this call on that, Carl.
Okay, look, that'd be helpful. I guess the one response, it doesn't seem like the EBITDA for the two segments is broken out. I know you've mentioned the ability to calculate it, but like that's probably the key element that I don't see at this point. But thanks for the offer of a follow-up. I guess the last thing then, if I just think about the fourth quarter implied EBITDA / IFM fee-related earnings, that looks to me to have been, I think, 16.6 million in the fourth quarter, which was below the third quarter and the second quarter. Is that correct? And is there anything that you would point to that's driving that?
I don't have the exact numbers to hand, but that sounds directionally correct. I think clearly there's a couple of things which are driving that. One is, I guess the final bonus accrual for the full year, which given the strength of the final quarter and the third quarter compared with the first half of the year, you know when you look at how we accrued the bonus through last year. Clearly, deployment was relatively lower in the first half versus the second half. So there was a higher bonus accrual given the increase in performance. And obviously, when you look at management fees, there is a quarterly lag to effectively those fees. So we the fees from in any quarter are based upon the NAV and the deployed capital of the funds at the prior quarter end. So effectively Q4 in last year is based upon Q3, and therefore you do get a bit of timing mismatch between some of the costs and some of those revenues just by quarter on quarter. So they're the two factors I'd point to.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you. With this, I'd like to hand the call back over to Zach Lubey for closing remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey, and appreciate the engagement. We very much look forward to reviewing our Q1s in May, and if at any point you have any questions as you go through the decks, and we appreciate that hopefully generally the clarity of the presentation has improved this period. But as Carl highlighted, if there's anything else you want to see, you know, please be in touch. But otherwise, thank you for your time today and look forward to talking with you in May. Thanks.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.